Okay, well, while that's loading, I can just introduce. So I'm going to be talking about an initiative that we've started in the way that we're running undergraduate projects to try and improve the reproducibility and reliability of our findings. And so through today's, can you all hear me at the back? I'm basically quite an early career researcher compared to some of the other speakers here today. And 2 years pretty much today, I started my first lectureship. And I sort of embarked on that in the psychology department, thinking about how I might train the undergraduates that I am then going to have to teach, and thinking about undergraduate final year dissertation projects, the research projects they all do in particular. I was reflecting upon my training throughout my kind of early career, and I did my undergraduate at Cambridge. I did it in natural sciences. I specialised in neuroscience, and there was obviously research methods training and research dissertation design in that. But the statistics didn't seem to align very well with the actual kind of research design methods. And then I moved to Bristol and I did a MEd in the psychology of education. And again, I had a load of statistical training, quantitative, qualitative, and so on. And I found through both those experiences, it was more an exercise in trying to identify the line of SPSS output that you need to put into your paper, rather than having a real grasp of why we might be doing inferential statistics and how we might interpret our results, understanding the play of chance within that. And it wasn't really until I started doing my PhD at the School of Social and Community Medicine in Bristol, and I went on a medical introduction to medical statistics basic course, week-long course, that I really started to get a handle for the play of chance within these things. And I wondered whether it was because medical epidemiologists have to train doctors to interpret statistical results through the prism of, would I give this drug to my grandmother based on the certainty I hold about this finding? And I think that throws the way we use our evidence into sharp contrast, because we're then having to really think about how much belief we play in that evidence, and it has real-world implications if we get it wrong. So I then was very lucky during that time to also work on a randomised controlled trial of internet-based therapy for depression. And I probably learnt more working on this large-scale trial in terms of research methods and training than I had in my whole career up until that point. And that also made me reflect on, we don't necessarily learn very much when we're doing something poorly. And yeah, you can gain something from the undergraduate projects that I did and the master's projects and so on. But it was basically an exercise in discussing the limitations of the research I'd done, because they were small, underpowered, and problematic in lots of ways. It would be much nicer if we were being able to invest our efforts, even at the early undergraduate stage, into research that is perhaps more meaningful and contributing to a greater whole. So Marcus earlier talked a lot about the problems that we have with reproducibility, and a previous speaker as well talked about low statistical power, and we basically have a problem where we don't necessarily adopt the most rigorous practices, and these might increase the probability of our results being false positive results. We have low statistical power, we have questionable research practices, a lack of control for bias in our designs, maybe we're not blinding and so on, and also perhaps a lack of transparency in the way that we report it. And all of this is leveraging chance so that we might be more likely to find positive results, but they're also more likely to be false positive. As Marcus said, we have a current system which really rewards positive results rather than rigorous methods, and we really like novelty as well. And so we have this kind of difficulty where we need to try and align our training and incentives for career progression with doing really rigorous scientific research. So in a kind of schematic, I think the reproducibility problem we have is we have publication bias, a preference for positive results. We have this dramatic publish or perish culture where our careers are all determined by the number of publications we have. And this drives us desperate researchers to questionable research practices to try and p-hack our way to something that will get our mortgage paid, but perhaps means that most of the evidence base is not particularly reliable. So this is the wider cultural problem we have in science. And how does this relate to undergraduate psychology projects? Well, if you think about the average cohort of psychology students, I think we've got about 100 at Bath starting this year. Each of those, as they go through their career, will end up doing a final year dissertation in that final year. So we've got 100 or so final year research projects happening. Multiple projects, these are often poorly resourced because they don't have much time. They've got to run within a certain single year time frame. They often don't have any money attached to them. Often they have limited access to participants, or at least certain populations of interest, especially in Bath, where we're at the top of a massive hill, so it's quite tricky getting participants to travel up on the bus without reimbursement. And also there's variability in the methodological expertise, both of supervisors and students and so on. We also work within an assessment framework or criteria where we're quite often focusing on individual contributions. And we kind of really value creativity and independence of thought and novelty. So this can often result in lots of multiple studies, which are often small and underpowered, perhaps not the best designs in the world, testing novel hypotheses, perhaps rather than looking at replication, maybe having little consideration for the integration of design with statistics and so on, depending on, you know, this is going to be hugely variable across institutions and research groups. And there may be scope for questionable research practices, such as p-hacking, multiple testing, and so on, especially given that we know these practices go on within the wider scientific community. So it doesn't kind of stretch thought too much to think that supervisors might be embarking or using some of these practices themselves, so maybe not being so hot on picking up on it in their students, or maybe even encouraging it in their students. I remember being told when I was starting my PhD, someone said to me, "Oh, don't worry, just bung loads of measures in, you'll always be able to find something." You know, that's a kind of common folklore that we have sometimes. So I'm now going to give an example of the base rate argument that came up earlier. So suppose we have 90% of student projects where the null hypothesis is true. And we set the significant level to the classic textbook 5%, and we then set the average power to 20%. Which probably isn't unrealistic for an undergraduate population of studies. We then perhaps have 100 undergraduates doing a project in our year, and of those, there'll be 100 true associations, and of those, we will be able to detect 20% of them, so two. Of the remaining 90 non-associations, we're going to falsely declare between four and five of them as statistically significant at the 5% level. Now suppose those significant findings are the ones that get submitted for publication. We've got a positive predictive value within that of two out of three. So two out of three of those published findings will be false positives. Now, I remember when I was doing my undergraduate at Cambridge, there was a few students each year from their undergraduate projects that would be lucky enough to get published. And it was always a bit of an excitement, you know, wow, they got an undergraduate publication. Maybe things have moved on a bit since then, because it was a while now. But, you know, you always think, God, they're really lucky. And then they are lucky because they're also at a career advantage, even at that early stage. But when we think about it in this context, you know, if you've got 100 undergraduates doing a project, then the risk of false positives is really quite high. And so we're kind of sending the wrong message. Here we have, I didn't try to point it back in, here we have years along the bottom, and this is a plot of the faculty positions each year in the US, and then the number of PhD students that sort of leave it or awarded their PhD in the US. And you can see there's an ever-increasing gap between those two things. So we know that it's becoming more and more competitive to develop a career in science, and it's just increasingly so. And Marcus kind of alluded to this earlier, but this is a really nice paper using authors in PubMed to kind of identify, I think it was machine learning, to identify predictors of what would predict whether somebody would go on to become a principal investigator. So we have, I think that's red at the top, and then non-PIs are in blue. And the two biggest predictors are number of first author publications, and then the impact factor of the journals in which those publications are published in. And if you're interested in gender bias in science, the third one is whether you're male or female. But that's a whole other talk. And then we know that significant results that are published in high-impact journals aren't necessarily almost the most reliable of findings, and this is a really nice figure from Marcus. I'm not sure if you can see it, but basically we have impact factor of the journal on the bottom, and then we have degree of bias in the research finding on this axis, and the size of the bubble is the size of the sample in which the evidence was generated. And you can see here that we have this teeny tiny small-scale study with a hugely inflated effect estimate published in one of the top most high-impact journals. And if you run an actual, there's a weak but significant correlation that the higher the impact factor of the journal, the more degree of bias and the smaller the sample size of the research published in it. So we know we're sending the wrong messages. And before people even get into this PhD situation, if you've an undergraduate with a publication, you're already miles ahead of your contemporaries. So what are the solutions? Well, when we've been thinking about this, there are various pockets of very good practice across a range of biomedical disciplines. So clinical trials has been leading the way in some areas with protocol and analysis plan pre-registration, specifying the primary outcome variable up front and publishing it so you can't deviate or switch outcomes later on. And we have some excellent reporting guidelines. So we have the consort guidelines for clinical trials, but then we also have PRISMA for systematic reviews. And then working with Marcus, who works with GWAS data, there's also these large-scale efforts to pool resources to be able to get at the kind of effect sizes that it seems that individual genes and so on are having. This requires really quite large-scale collaboration. So there's been some development in the ways that people are having to harmonise the way they measure things and harmonise their procedures and so on. So this led to us in our paper in 2013 to kind of make these recommendations for scientists. The first one is it's very important if we're doing robust science to have an a priori power calculation, really think about the size of the sample that you're using so you have the precision in your estimates to be able to say something meaningful at the end, and we heard about that just in the previous talk. I think probably if there was one thing other than a power calculation that could solve many of these issues that we have is pre-registration of study protocols. And I know Chris Chambers will be talking about registered reports as a mechanism in journals later, but it is the one thing that keeps us all honest, because you have to specify what you're doing up front, and it just prevents all of those questionable research practices that can creep in later. And so in the context of undergraduate studies, how do we get sufficiently large samples given the small scale kind of lack of resources and timescales and so on? Well, that really has to come through working collaboratively. And we've updated kind of the various suggestions in the more recent manifesto for reproducible science. And again, you can see there's collaboration, where is it, team science comes in at somewhere, and then we've got training and methods. So really, thinking about where we can start this training, I think it should start at the undergraduate levels before we can let bad practices sort of get into the zeitgeist or the mentality. So in 2016, we suggested a potential solution for undergraduate training, which was this idea of doing multi-centre undergraduate projects. So drawing on best practices from clinical trials and GWAS studies, this idea that if we can work collaboratively across institutions, we can improve the quality of both the research training and also the quality of the research outputs, both for the actual research happening now, but also hopefully for all the research that those undergraduates, if they pursue a career in research, will be doing in the future. The idea of collaboration, it being able to be one way that we can get to those larger sample sizes so we can start to look at more precise effect estimates. But also it starts to get into some of these questions of generalizability. So if we're measuring something across multiple sites, then we can start to look at site-specific effects and hopefully say something more generalizable. How different the undergraduate populations are at the individual institutions is a whole other question, but maybe we can be more generalizable to undergraduate populations across the UK rather than just in Bath. And then we can also think about increasing the transparency and improve the quality of our reporting, because when you're working collaboratively, you have to get your procedures much more rigorously in place so that everybody can start following the same standard operating procedures. So this was the basic structure in the first project that we ran, and it was a collaboration between the GW4 universities, so that's Bath, Bristol, Cardiff and Exeter. And I worked with colleagues, Chris, who's in the room, Natalia Lawrence from Exeter, Marcus, who's just left, and myself. And we wrote an article together, but we chose this collaboration based on our interest in meta-science, which actually was quite interesting when we got down to trying to decide the actual topic of the research, because it's meant that we've ended up doing something where we're not necessarily all researchers working on the same primary research, we just have an interest in meta-research. So that's introduced some interesting kind of tensions. So the way the project actually looks is like this, because of the different timescales and trying to advertise these projects to students. Marcus didn't find any students from Bristol to take part, so it ended up being a consortium between Exeter, Cardiff and Bath, so we should call ourselves the GW3. And what we decided was we took this structure. So we had the primary research question, which was something that both Christopher and Natalia had worked in before, and this is Rachel Adams, who's a postdoc in Chris's group. And we then recruited students from each of the different institutions, and each of us PIs in the different centres will be the supervisor, and then all these students will be the ones that will work on it to collect their, or have worked on the project to collect their data. It might be that next year we choose a project led by from Bath, and it might be that I have one of my PhD students or postgraduate students that has a research idea that they would quite like to lead on. But something that's really come out of the first undergraduate consortium that we've run is that this really requires project management, and I think that needs to be done at the PGR or postdoc level. Because as an early new lecturer, it was actually quite difficult trying to find the time to do the level of preparation and planning that one needs to do when you're doing everything up front with protocol pre-registration, developing harmonised materials and so on. So we were very lucky in that Rachel Adams has been a stalwart of this initial project, and she will be taking the lead and writing up and is finishing off data collection on this on the first attempt. So the kind of timeline that we operated to, we spent some time, and you really can't start this early enough, but really as the one consortium's getting going, you want to be thinking about what you're doing the following year for the next consortium. And because of the timescale and work it needs up front when you're doing more reproducible science, we're thinking about these things over, say, from January till June. The way it seems to be working best is if we have a PGR student or a postdoc who has a particular research interest, they basically develop a research question and the research materials and a basic research protocol, and we all discuss that over the kind of Lent term to the summer term. And then we gear up till the autumn consortium meeting, which is when the students first start in October. We then have a meeting fairly early on in October. Ours is going to be on the 11th of October, where we give the students the reading material and the bare bones protocol, but they each have to think about another variable or a hypothesis that they might like to add into that protocol. So that gives them some chance to kind of experience a bit of research design and hypothesis generation and so on. Then at the meeting, they each present their additional kind of secondary variable or its additional hypothesis to the group. And in the current round that we're doing, we have about 10 minutes of time within the research protocol. So the students will then collaborate together and decide which of those additional measures they think are most important and fit most well with the research design. And together we'll come to a consensus, and then they will add that into the protocol. So that allows the students to be authors on the protocol development. We also use these meetings for the sort of the lead postdoctoral or PGR researcher to show the students how to run any of the kind of test procedures and data collection and so on, and use that as a training exercise so we can try and harmonise and standardise procedures across the different student groups. And that where it varies between consortiums. So the GW4 consortium, we will have all of that covered in one meeting because we're collecting our data through online program tasks, so it's actually quite minimal the amount of setup that the individual labs require, because effectively the participants come in, they sit in front of a computer, and it's just a case of logging on to the or connecting to the online platform where the experiments will run. But I'm also doing this year a consortium with colleagues down in Southampton, which is going to be using TDCS to look at autobiographical memory in social anxiety and whether we can disrupt that with stimulation to the prefrontal cortex. So that's a much more involved kind of research setup. So the student who is leading on that is a Deakin Psych student down at Southampton, and she is coming up to Bath to spend a day training my undergraduate students to make sure that they're completely au fait with the kind of the procedure that they need to run there. So there's kind of different ways to do it, but I think getting that sort of early career level management in there is really quite important. Then we registered the protocol, and then data collection runs from November to February. And then in Easter, we then have the second consortium meeting, which is where we discuss results and dissemination. So they can have an element of individuality within that. They may not be all writing up the same elements of the overall research project. So the research project will have a primary outcome, but there may be secondary things included within that. So the individual students can focus on slightly different elements of the project for their dissertation, but obviously it will all be included in the final write-up for publication. And so at that Easter consortium meeting, the students bring their own independent dissertation analysis and present it to the group sequentially, and then they get to discuss between them any differences that they have in interpretation of those results and so on. And it's quite interesting because working in that way, you do get people interpret results quite differently, and it's quite interesting for them to experience how, you know, data interpretation is not black and white, and everybody brings their own biases to that process. So the project that we chose for the first GW4 undergraduate consortium was to do a replication and an extension of a previously published finding. So there had been previously published some work looking at training response inhibition to food and how it might be associated with weight loss and reduced calorie intake. Now, this isn't my research area at all, so I ended up learning a lot about inhibition to training to food. But what we thought would be quite nice is if we start with a replication project where we're saying, okay, we want to replicate that main treatment effect, but then to give the students some scope to have their own input into the study design, they were then able to come to the first meeting and bring ideas for variables that they thought might moderate that treatment effect. So we have a kind of the first part's a replication, and then the second part that the students, and it's a bit more exploratory, but to see whether individual variables might moderate treatment response. So we based our initial sample size on the treatment effect from the original study, from Natalia et al.'s original study, and to replicate the effect they found with 80% power and alpha 5%, we'd have needed 106 participants. But because each student is then contributing their own moderator hypothesis or variable to the analysis, we obviously needed to massively increase that sample size because they have to have some power to be able to detect treatment modification, which will require lots more power. We set the primary outcome as the replication of the treatment effect. And so we basically quadrupled our sample size to try and allow them some sensitivity to look at moderator effects. So we were looking to recruit a sample of N equals 412. We actually only got to 238 participants, but data collection is being continued in Cardiff. That's underpowered for moderators, but would have been amply sufficient for the main replication treatment effect. So the idea of me showing you this is because we were trying to build in some kind of square the circle of the students having some input, but also making sure that you've got at least one thing in there that you're doing really well. So the replication was always going to be really well powered. Yeah, moderators are always a bit more exploratory, we know that, but at least then it kind of allows the students to have some input and then us still to do some kind of quality research, hopefully. So we collectively wrote the protocol. We actually led on that at Bath in the first consortium, and I had my undergraduate. I had to do quite a lot of work to tweak it to make it kind of more suitable for publication on open science frameworks. So what we're doing now is having the PGR student or the postdoc that's kind of going to take the lead on the study will draft the protocol, and then the students are having more of a kind of limited input in the sense that they will draft their... collectively draft the hypothesis they want to add in, so they've met the criteria for authorship, but we're doing enough quality control on the overarching thing so that it is... It, and then the protocol is published. And what's nice about publishing on the Open Science Framework and other repositories is that they give you a DOI. So all of our undergraduate students that have taken part in this now have a citable DOI on their CVs, which kind of helps with their career development. So in terms of other elements for this kind of solutions, we hope to disclose our methods and results findings transparently, and pre-registration really helps with that because you have that clear audit trail of what you said you're going to do at the beginning and what you'll say you're going to do at the end. And hopefully this will provide and discourage us and our students from adopting questionable research practices. What I found from having done quite a few pre-registrations now is that my primary analysis has always been null, actually. Yeah, and I think we'd expect that if you're really sticking to a very stringent pre-registration. We then say, oh, well, it's because we should have looked at this, that, and the other, and you can all do all of that as exploratory, and you always find really exciting stuff in your exploratory analysis. But actually, I think that's something that's been really, when you really nail your colours to the mast, actually quite often you don't find for your... And it's just important for the students to kind of see that as well. So hopefully by working collaboratively, it means that our results might be more generalisable and that we might be able, we plan to publish our final data sets as well on data repositories. So in terms of benefits and costs, I think students have had less creativity perhaps and scope for individuality, but arguably the preference for novelty over reliability is one that has perhaps contributed to the current problem. Somebody, I can't remember who said it, but I've heard a few good sort of anecdotes about if you think about artists being some of the most creative people we have, the fine art masters spend years and years and years honing their technique before they create these wonderful masterpieces. And I think science is a bit like that. We need to really train in the rigorous methods, and then the creativity kind of comes perhaps towards the end when you have a good grounding in research methods. It's slightly trickier in terms of assessing the individual contribution within a sort of wider collaborative. But I do think they gain more of a rigorous training. And on the one hand, while perhaps the students that I had felt that they could relax a bit more into the fact there were so many other people collecting data, perhaps they didn't have to try and work quite as hard as if they were doing it on their own. It also meant that they were able to produce perhaps a higher quality research output than they would have done had they been working on their own, because the structure, I think, helps weaker students as well in giving them something to kind of work within. And also, I think they can participate actively in a quality research project, and hopefully, if they do get an undergraduate project published, it's for the right reasons and not just because they were the one out of 100 who by chance happened to get the p less than 0.05. So I have just a couple of concluding remarks. Poor methods and questionable research practices mean that many of the published findings are likely to be false, as we heard in the previous talks. We have solutions. There is best practice, but quite often these rigorous research methods do take more time and resources. Systemic change is happening, though. Funders, publishers, researchers are all moving on this, so we really need to make sure we're preparing our undergraduates for a future for open science. So consortium studies offer a way to tackle these issues. They do take a little bit more organisation and setup, but we are allowing our students then to hopefully participate in rigorous methods from the start. And the idea is that we can instill best practice from the grassroots up so that we can change scientific culture from the grassroots up. So I'd like to say thank you to a few people and then open for questions.